Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about the Yukon XL Eco Diesel, Maserati Quattroporte, and the Acura Type S. We'll get into some Tesla news, talk Concours, and finally we'll spend your money. I'm going to bring in road test editor Zach Palmer, who is about to head out to drive the Nissan Frontier. That's pretty exciting, so we'll tease that out for a future episode. But how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I'm excited. I'm going out to Utah to drive this Frontier tomorrow, actually. So this is one of the, I guess, my first time on the other side of the Mississippi since the pandemic started.
Yeah, man. So should be exciting. And Utah is a beautiful state. I drove the Ford GT out there on a track. And it's just, you know, obviously the GT on a track is great. But just on some of those open roads, just like the views, the mountains, I think you're going to have a lot of fun. And I think the Frontier is going to be a really interesting truck.
I think so, too. Looks great in photos. So we'll see how it drives.
Cool. Cool. So let's jump right in. I spent last week in the Eco Diesel Yukon XL. In simple terms, this is a dressed up Chevy Suburban. You might recall Yukon and Yukon XL are Suburban and, or excuse me, Tahoe and Suburban siblings, if you will. So plenty of room back there. I actually spent two earlier stints in the Suburban Eco Diesel, so I'm very familiar with just the basic underpinnings in this engine. I was trying to focus on, is the Yukon XL like really worth it? I should mention it was a Denali trim. Mine came at about 84.6. So honestly, that seemed like, this is going to sound crazy, that seemed like a pretty good deal to me, just for a Yukon Denali with this kind of interesting engine. One of my neighbors stopped by and was looking at it. And he's like, this looked like the presidential like motorcade thing. And I'm like, well, those are Escalades and that's the beast. And this is a Yukon, but I think that's a compliment, if you will. So it's a capable engine. You know, you're looking at 20 miles in the city, 26 highway, 22 combined for something that literally is as big as like a presidential motorcade troop transporter that the Secret Service could ride in. That's pretty good fuel economy, I think. In some configurations, you can tow like 8,000-9,000 pounds with the Eco Diesel, depending on, you know, like the Sierra, you can tow a little bit more. Four-wheel drive, two-wheel drive, there's some like variance there, but pretty capable engine. It's actually slightly cheaper. I was specking this out. It's about $1,600 less than the 6.2-liter V8. I would strongly consider that. I feel like at this price point, you're probably not looking to save money, you know, either way, like $1,600 on an $85,000 vehicle. You know, I don't think that's a consideration, but I mean, I think I might get this engine for the fuel economy and the towing and just the torque. It's in its own way, it's fun to drive. So, I mean, broad strokes though, when I look at this, it feels like, to me, the General Motors has really nailed its latest generation of full-size truck-based SUVs. And I know you spent some time in the Escalade, which is essentially this with Super Cruise and nicer lights. This has awesome lights, though, I would say. I mean, what do you think of that statement? You think, is that fair to say that these new GMT SUVs are like where they should be?
I think from like a ride and interior and looks perspective, absolutely yes. Would I love to see something like a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid version in addition to all the V8s? Also yes. But the one that you just drove here, that Eco Diesel, I feel is probably the one to get. I've driven that engine in the Silverado and I love it. Really, really love that engine. It is so, so smooth. You wouldn't even assume that it's a diesel. You know, it's not one of those old clackety, noisy diesel engines that Americans tend to not like. No, this is smooth and good enough that you can throw it in an Escalade and it still feels luxurious and, you know, as it's supposed to be there. But yeah, overall, I mean, you look at the tech portfolio and the actual interior design and interior quality on these new IRS full-sizers. And, you know, GM is right there, right at the top of the heap in pretty much every class. You look at Escalade, Yukon, Suburban, There's a little something there for everybody at all the price points. And if you need to move a lot of people and a lot of stuff, it's hard to beat that. Except if you go for a minivan, but of course then you don't have towing.
It's true. It's true. You know that the IRS does make a big difference on this new generation of full-size, crossover SUVs, I should say. They handle better. I feel like they handle, it's a cliche, but I feel like they do handle a little bit smaller and more nimbly than they are. I mean, driving the old Tahoes, Suburbans, Yukons was a chore. It was a lot of work. This is still a very large vehicle, but it's a little bit less work. And they also have made for like a better layout in the back. It's like one of those things where it's like with the new like IRS, it allowed them to move some other things around, and that opened up just a little bit of a more, it's more cargo space, quite simply. And that was one of the things they were touting when I was driving the Suburban, and also applies, of course, to the Yukon and the Yukon XL. Really, for these, it sort of comes down to like, what do you want? Do you want to get everything and convey the image of driving the Escalade, maybe get Super Cruise? Do you want a vehicle that's almost as, I would say, over the top? And that is the Yukon XL, especially Denali trim. I mean, the headlights on the Denali Yukon were more crazy than the Cadillac headlights, actually, if you look at them. The Cadillac grille and some trims are a little, it's a little more reserved, if you will. There's like the headlights are a little bit smaller in simple terms. I actually kind of like the Tahoe and Suburban just from a like very simple aesthetic. So yeah, I mean, again, it just really comes down to what do you want, because mechanically they're the same, and the Tahoe and Suburban are a little understated compared to the other two, and I think that's by design. On the other hand, they're not cheap. So it's kind of like if you are going to start to spend that kind of money, you probably don't go from Chevy to Cadillac, but you might think of going from like Tahoe to Yukon, depending on, what you could get, what incentives are available, and that sort of thing. So, it's a strong portfolio right now for General Motors.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you do think of doing that jump, from a Suburban to say like a Yukon XL, I know previously, like the previous generations, the basic interior design and look was very similar. Maybe there's a couple more pieces of leather and or fake wood here and there, but when you jump from just like a normal Yukon to a Yukon Denali, or from a Suburban to a Denali specifically, you get a different interior, which was really bizarre to me actually to see at the launch that you have like a whole different interior design, a different center stack, a different infotainment screen, and all that just for going up to Denali. But that sort of speaks to the actual Denali brand itself. Just GMC has recognized that people absolutely love that, and now they're giving you an interior that is more fit to that. When somebody says, "Oh, I got a Denali," well, it is actually remarkably different inside than just a normal GMC Yukon, which I think is pretty cool.
I think across the board, these vehicles have much better interiors. The Denali is sort of a, I think that's a smart strategic play for GMC to actually really differentiate it from the other Yukons and, non-Denali vehicles and, of course, Chevy. But to go back to like the Chevy example, I was blown away by how good the Suburban interior is. The last generation, you had to actually spend a little bit of money to not look like you were driving an enclosed Silverado with an okay interior. And now the Suburban and the Tahoe look very nice inside. So I think, frankly, the last few Chevys I have driven, the Bolt and the Suburban, have had very nice interiors. So I think that the Corvette actually has a very nice interior too. So I feel like strategically Chevy's interiors are moving in the right place, and then you're starting to see some of the upper, upscale interiors also go that place. And they have to. Like you're looking at interiors like at a variety of price points, whether you're talking the premium space like Genesis or all the way up to like a Lincoln, which is legit luxury, and they're like throwing like 1960s, mid-century, modern things at you. Like, really, if you're going to have a premium SUV, you got to bring it, you know, and if you're going to try and be true luxury, you got to bring it. So, you know, that said, the Denali interior in the Yukon XL was quite nice, quite nice. So
definitely. Yeah.
So how we shift gears to even higher luxury at the Maserati. You have the Quattroporte. Which Quattroporte were you driving? How much did it cost, roughly?
So it was the Quattroporte Trofeo, specifically, okay, which is the new top dog for 2021. MSRP just north of $150,000. So
wow,
not cheap by any means. But I know, just as you and I were talking before the show about Maserati, you know, maybe they're a little mystical. Their lineup isn't exactly the most obvious thing anymore. If you are wondering which one the Quattroporte is, just sort of think of it as like the S-Class sized of all the different Maseratis. You got that one, you got the Ghibli, which is smaller, and then the Levante. But the operative word in all of this is Trofeo, because that means that it has the Ferrari V8 engine in it, which makes it instantly extremely cool. So it's the 3.9 liter twin turbo V8, 580 horsepower, 538 pound feet of torque, rear wheel drive, gets horrendous fuel economy, but you're going to have a really, really great time getting that pretty horrible fuel economy. Just for disclosure, I average about 12 mpg in my week with it. So that's around Hellcat territory right there. And just as you would suspect, the V8 is freakishly good. There's nothing in this segment that sounds anywhere close to as good as this one is. I know I spent most of the weeks motoring around in sport and Corsa mode, which opens the flaps and the exhaust. And yeah, it 100% sounds like a Ferrari V8. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You're driving one of the coolest sounding big luxury sedans on the road. Doesn't really matter if you get in an S63 AMG or an Audi S8. Even, you know, like a BMW M760i, this thing is going to sound a lot better and definitely make you happy in that way. Unfortunately, that's, you know, the powertrain is around where my, I guess, effusive praise will die down for this car. So for a multitude of reasons, most of them having to do with the ride and handling quality of it. So you see the Trofeo name and you instantly think, all right, so this thing's going to handle pretty well. This is going to be like a big luxury sedan, like an S63, or like an S8, as I mentioned. However, it's not exactly that. It's more land yacht barge-like than anything. I was actually reading Maserati's press material, and they said that they didn't actually do anything to the suspension or chassis for the Trofeo model. They were basically going on, well, the GTS and standard Quattroporte was good enough, and this one is just about the engine. And that's about what it is, because the handling on this is, well, it's sort of uncoordinated, very rolly, not exactly what you would think when you hear the word Trofeo. And with that, you know, not so great handling, you would expect, oh, so it rides really well, right? It's a super plush cruiser. Unfortunately, it is not the softest thing out there either. It's rather harsh over a bunch of potholes and frost heaves. You know, any 7 series or S class of that matter, even like a 5 series or anything, is gonna ride better and be more comfortable from an actual daily driving perspective. So that was pretty disappointing to me, just to see that. You know, the upside is this is you have a fantastic engine. Like, that is where your money is going, to that lovely Ferrari engine. But the actual ride and handling leaves much to be desired. Another bright point of this thing was they gave it a new infotainment system this year. It got Uconnect 5, which was a massive improvement over the old like reskinned Uconnect 4. That infotainment system just felt a bit lost in Maseratis before. It's the same thing that you get in like a $35,000 Pacifica, and here it is in this $150,000 Quattroporte. But now with Uconnect 5, honestly, it feels just as luxurious as, say, you're stepping into a BMW or something of that matter. Super smooth, super clean graphics, and it's actually there. But this is a weird car because it's tough to find like who would actually want one of these. And at the end of the week, I just came down to you have to be a Maserati and or Ferrari enthusiast, to want this kind of vehicle because it gives you that Italian exotic feel from the engine. It's like the most buttery smooth, creamy engine. And it sounds so good under every bridge and overpass you go under. So if that's what you want, that's who this car is for, I think. But I think that there's still a lot that Maserati needs to do to bring this up to snuff with a lot of its other competitors.
And that's actually a place I'm curious your thoughts here. I feel like Maserati sometimes falls short in making its cars emotional, and well, I think they actually do an okay job making them emotional and exciting, but they still don't feel super special to me. And then there's just like the execution of it. It's like you look at competitors for BMW, Mercedes, especially the Germans, where it's like, well, they're just going to offer you these other things that make your life better as a driver and as a user. And they're like, their electronics work better, like there's nicer features inside. So, I mean, it does sort of come down to like, well, hey, you do have the Ferrari V8. That's a trump card. But then it's like, unless you're just in love with the idea of a Maserati, literally that, in love with the idea of a Maserati, you're probably best served going someplace else. And I honestly can't believe I'm saying this, but it seems like Mercedes and BMW are better values than Maseratis, so I feel like there's some work for Maserati here, primarily in their product executions to, make up some ground here.
Yeah, I mean, the actual like quality, like build quality of the interior and exterior is like top notch. Like this, it is really, really nice stuff. All the leather that they use, some of the nicest feeling leather I've ever felt, frankly, and all the carbon fiber. But then there's just some weird things on the interior that like the push button start and the headlight switch and the window switches are exactly the same as you'd find in like a Dodge Charger, and like not changed at all. Like literally just lifted straight out of there and then put in this Maserati. And maybe if you haven't driven a Dodge Charger or have exposure to a bunch of Dodge products, you won't notice. But us having driven all these cars, we see that, and it's like, oh, this is the turn signal stock out of the Charger I drove the other week. Interesting. So yeah, just stuff like that, would go maybe not a long way, but some way into making the car feel more special from an interior perspective.
I drove this engine in the Levante Trofeo a couple years back, and the engine is brilliant. It's probably more than you need, especially in like a Levante, which is just, a crossover, if you will. The GTS is very capable. You're still north of like 500, 550 horsepower. So you don't really need the Trofeo, if you will, which will get you somewhere quick with the golden retriever and the takeout and all that stuff. I was willing to give the Levante a little bit more of a pass because it was like it's a crossover, whereas when you're talking about the Quattroporte, which is a car, I feel like as a Maserati it has to live up to sort of like a higher standard. It really has to translate some sporting ethos into its dynamics and really just have that special feel and also have a luxurious element. To me, it kind of sounds like the Quattroporte falls a little bit short. Whereas when I looked at the Levante, it was just like, hey, it looks pretty good. It looks different than things you'd see from the Germans. Build quality is actually pretty good. it's sort of like the curve was a little bit different, and that's why I think I was willing to give it a break. I mean, it is a brilliant engine, though. I mean, it's a Ferrari engine. Yeah, it's hard not to like that. And I think Maserati is in a bit of an interesting spot. They're trying to get the MC20 out, which I think we're going to drive that later this fall. It's a very important car, and that's sort of like where you get the reset, like what is Maserati, and then you build out from there.
Yeah. No, I think they're in a big brand transition right now where they're trying to like phase out some of these older cars like the Quattroporte and the Ghibli, and they're going to come out like you said that MC20, and that's going to be their halo, something to look at like this is what Maserati means in this decade. And then they're going to come out with that Grecale crossover, which that's going to be hopefully a really good Macan fighter. And then, of course, they have their new engine, the Nettuno twin turbo V6, that hopefully they'll share that around the lineup. And that thing is going to be, well, it's going to make every one of their cars a bit of a rocket ship. And it probably won't make us miss the Ferrari V8s that much, since this is the last generation of Maseratis with Ferrari engines for the time being.
One thing I think that Alfa Romeo does a little bit better than Maserati is make you sort of like ignore their shortcomings. Whereas I feel like with, and maybe it's just the price, like a $40,000-$50,000 Giulia, it's like, hey, this thing looks amazing. Interior is nice, but parts of it don't look great or don't feel great. But oh, hey, it's got that also has like a Ferrari engine in it. Or some of the lesser engines are still quite capable, and it still looks like a Giulia, or like a Quadrifoglio is amazing. It feels like right now, at least for me as an enthusiast and a guy who likes Italian cars and is actually half Italian, as you might imagine, Alfa is more like the brand that I tend to skew towards. And then Maserati is, of course, it's a luxury, like a higher up the food chain luxurious, thing. But I don't know, and I'm not even trying to put that all together, other than to say it feels like I'm willing to give Alfa a break because their cars cost less. Maybe that's a way just to distill it down. But I also feel like their design is better right now. A special Alfa Romeo Giulia is awesome to drive and it looks amazing. And you, I mean, many comparison tests that, some of the other buff books have done have made it a very credible entry against BMW, Cadillac, Mercedes. So it's like, you can see how it can be done right. And Alfa has its own problems, as we all know. But I don't know. To me, the template feels more like, hey, I wouldn't say Alfa has a template, but it feels like their path is a little bit better. So,
I completely agree with you. I think that Alfa's new cars are, well, both the Stelvio and the Giulia are just huge successes for somebody who, wants a luxury enthusiast vehicle. Both of them, from the base to the Quadrifoglio, they're just all brilliant to drive, and God, they look so good.
they just need a spider duetto. Seriously, they do.
Give us a spider. I'm all for
Let's do it. They
it.
have the design. I mean, they don't change it. Just do that. Probably electrify it or come up with a brilliant engine for a 5 years here until you've got to be all electric and go from there, man. So,
Exactly. Retro design is in.
it
Keep it
is. It
up.
is. So, how about this Acura Type S you were driving?
Yeah. TLX Type S. This was one that I was really, really looking forward to. I spent a little while, obviously, with our long-term TLX, and honestly, like my two biggest complaints with that car were the engine and the transmission. The engine sounded good, but I'd be lying if I didn't say I wanted more power. And the 10-speed automatic, the logic for when you threw it in sport mode was not exactly that smart. It'd be upshifting all the time when you didn't want to. The paddles with manual mode were, on the slow side of things to respond. No problem with the handling at all, though. The handling of that car is absolutely superb. But I was hoping that the Type S would fix my two gripes there, and I can happily say that it has. The new 3-liter turbocharged V6, 355 horsepower, 354 pound-feet of torque, is a brilliant little thing. You know, it may look down on power versus like an M340i, or if you're looking at like the Q50 Red Sport 400, but I have no complaints at all with it. It's probably the most characterful engine in this group of cars, which Honda has had a knack of doing in the past, is making really good, really strong engines that make enthusiasts happy, and I think that this is another one. Revs super smoothly, great torque all the way up to red line, makes a really great, you know, just the pitch of the engine increases as you get higher in the rev range. It's just a super, super fun engine to ring out. And of course, we have V6 turbo power, so no more complaints about the actual thrust. It's awesome, and combined with the SH all-wheel drive system, it's just even more fun than before, since you can send even more power to those rear wheels. And then the transmission. This has like a fairly re like heavily revised 10-speed, a new torque converter in there, new clutches. They've beefed it up, and they said they get 40% quicker shifts, and I 100% believe that. Honestly, I might even if you hadn't have given me a number, I would have predicted that it was even quicker than 40% quicker shifts. Because you tap those paddles and it responds near instant response, sort of like the ZF8 speed on a BMW or an Audi. Just super, super quick reflexes, and that's exactly what I wanted in a performance sedan. That I mean, I would love a manual transmission, but this is really good. And it has a new Sport Plus mode as well for that transmission that actually gives it a super smart automatic shifting as well. So you can pound around your favorite back roads or the track, and it'll stay in the right gear, no shifting necessary. Now the only like small disappointment I'd say with this car, is because it's the new V6. And it's up there. The weight distribution is not as ideal as it is in the four cylinder, and unfortunately, you do feel that the car is a little more front heavy than ours. I believe it's like a 2 or 3% weight distribution difference, front to rear. It's not as extreme as you might feel in like a Mustang 5-liter V8 versus a Mustang EcoBoost. But you can 100% feel that there is a little extra weight on the front end up there as you're feeling the balance through corners. But besides that, looks fantastic. I really think that they killed it with the exterior design changes for the Type S. Engine, transmission, lovely. Interior, mostly the same as the regular TLX, just a little nicer bolsters on the seats. Overall, really, really well executed car, and at the price point that it's at, you know, you can make a really, really solid argument that you should buy this over, say, like a BMW M340i or like a C43 AMG, because if you want the same luxury features and all of the tech that comes standard in this Acura at 55, you gotta spend north of 60, nearing $70,000 in most of those Germans. You can get those Germans base without all of those options for around the same price as the Acura, but you're definitely getting a better value when you go for that for the TLX Type S, I think.
I think the Type S offers something kind of different and special. It does sort of build on that heritage of Acura, like, you know, motorsports history and performance. You know, I didn't drive it, but even driving just the base TLX that we have in our long-term fleet, I felt some of that like Acura DNA, like the good DNA from like the 80s and 90s, kind of coursing through its veins, if you will. And the car made me excited to drive it and to see about this Type S. So this is certainly on my list of things that are, you know, available later in the fleet. I'd like to try it myself, obviously.
Noted.
Actually subtle here. But no, it sounds like, unlike with, say, the Quattroporte Trofeo, where we're kind of like picking it apart and trying to like obsess over the brand and its meaning. It really feels like the Type S just kind of connected, you know, with that like first shot off the tee and, you know, solid, you know, contact, and it landed where it should. So,
yeah, no, I absolutely. I'd driven a couple Type S's before this, an RSX Type S and an old CL Type S. That RSX Type S was the one that really spoke to me as, you know, this is what Type S performance means. And honestly, I feel like this is a solid revival of that, and, you know, from a performance and fun to drive standpoint. So Acura did the job it needed to do.
That's exciting. That's good to hear. And let's shift gears over to some news. We have a little bit going on this week, kind of a range of things here. The big news this week, Tesla reported earnings. They made a ton of money, even better than people thought they were going to do. But to really parse out like the product stuff that we care a little more about, Cybertruck and Semi are delayed. Basically, there was a moment, if you will, where Tesla said, hey, we think these are going to be out by 2021. They kind of hedged on the call and then later clarified, doesn't look like it's going to happen as scheduled. I don't think it's the biggest deal based on the whole like, well, they said they were going to do it this time and now they're going to do it later, because it always was probably going to be the end of this year. It wasn't going to be like January 1st. It was always going to be November, December. Whenever a car company says we're going to do something by this year, you know, plan on checking it out on New Year's Eve, you know? I mean, they're usually pretty cautious about that. You know, that being said, though, I think, you know, whether it comes out at the end of the year or, you know, the Cybertruck, that is, and the Semi, I think, is even more up in the air. To me, that's almost a project that they might want to consider. To me, that could be a distraction. Let me put it that way. It could also have broader implications as far as, like, moving goods and things from place to place, you know, could really change the game. But if you're going to be a car company, they don't generally always, like, you don't get every OEM doesn't focus on semis and everything else they're trying to get right. So to me, that's a little bit of like, you know, a pitcher that's got like its four-seam fastball, a good slider, and then they also try working on a knuckleball. Like, well, what are you doing there? You know, you don't necessarily need the knuckleball, you know? So I digress. I think the Cybertruck, to kind of bring it all together, what's going to happen here is, does it matter if it's out in November or February? Not really. But what you are seeing, though, is Lucid just did an IPO yesterday. You know, they're working on a crossover. It's not a Cybertruck competitor, but they're a credible EV maker in the space. We've now got the Lightning is a screaming deal, and you can order one now. And Ford will probably get it to you sometime when they say it will. You know, we're talking about Sierra, Silverado electrified. The Hummer is going to have a truck version. Rivian, Lordstown Motors, Bollinger. Faraday had some news today on, you know, something electric. So, you know, if you want an electric vehicle or specifically an electric truck, there's a lot of people that are like, hey, we can help you out with that. So that's where I think the broader implications are for Tesla, as in, hey, you want to get the Cybertruck out soon. So, I mean, that's kind of my hot take, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, the delay does not surprise me. It to me, it's just, you know, more of classic Tesla. I mean, I feel like every single product they've ever launched, they've said, yeah, it'll be out this year. And then at least 1 or 2 years after that, okay, here's the first ones rolling off the line. And you get a couple thousand out there. And then like a year after that, then they start becoming widely available. And I assume that's what'll happen with the Cybertruck. Assuming they do figure it out and actually do start production on that thing. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon at this point. And yeah, your point about the semis is well taken, because, you know, as you do take a step back and look, okay, so you got Daimler, they're making semis. You got Volvo, they've always been involved with that, but it's not like a big popular thing for, you know, most car companies to just hop into semis. And you have Tesla struggling, you know, just to get enough Model 3s, Model Ys, Model Ss out there for everybody. And, oh yeah, we're also designing an electric semi-truck, something that nobody else has ever done. And Yeah, it's just going to continue to be delayed. I know that it was announced back in 2017. So, I mean, we're running on like five. It's going to be 5, 6 years after it's announced before any customer actually gets their hands on it, assuming their latest timeline is even going to come to fruition.
Semis are the ultimate workhorse. You've really gotta like these trucks have to be like super reliable, bulletproof. You're gonna look at like the business model is different in some ways because it's like really, the independent like owner operators, if you will. The technology is a little bit different. Like, I mean, everything is just like it's a little bit of a different breed, It's like it's an interesting area to try to expand into, and you're not going to take a lot of your learnings, if you will, from the car business and, translate them to semi trucks, So that's tricky. Some of the battery technology for sure could translate, but I mean, you've got to get a whole new chassis, and like aerodynamic design. There's just, to me, it's sort of like putting more on your plate than is necessary. But I mean, the one thing, I was talking about this the other day with our friends at Yahoo Finance, and the one thing that you shouldn't get lost in the shuffle here is they actually did have their best second quarter ever with 200,000 deliveries, Tesla. They made a ton of money. I mean, these are KPIs that are good for the health of a company. And if Ford or Toyota or Honda or General Motors were just putting up good vitals, like that in and of itself is actually a really good thing, I think, for Tesla. So I think they're definitely stacking up some good metrics. And they I don't know. They I mean their financials were also hurt because they've invested like a bazillion dollars in Bitcoin. Like, I mean, there's just stuff when it comes to Tesla that does not apply to any other automaker. And frankly, that's cool. It's good for them as a company. It's good for their user base. And hey, it gives us something to talk about on the podcast. So now let's go even more off the grid here. You're following a story about some Maine, the Maine DMV, if you will, as in Maine, like the state of Maine, is sort of, sending letters to some people who own these old Mitsubishi vans, Delicas. I think I said that right.
Correct.
And just
Yes.
what's going on there?
Man, I wish I knew. That's the funny thing about this story. Like you said, I have been following it here quite closely, or at least as close as I am able to. But it all started, when a number of Mitsubishi Delica owners in Maine received letters from the state of Maine saying that they had to take the license plates off of their Delicas and ship them back to the state and let them know that their van is no longer road legal. Now, the reasoning for doing that is still semi elusive. How this all started is still semi elusive. However, Maine is starting to enforce a no Delica law almost. That's not what it is, but that is how it has effectively been here. Basically, there's a law that they say no off-road vehicles allowed in this state, and somehow Maine has classified the Delica as an off-road vehicle. Now, if you know what a Delica is, it's not exactly an off-road vehicle. It's a van that people have imported from Japan under the 25-year import rule, which we all know. In the U.S., it allows you to import vehicles that are over 25 years old that may not have met federal safety emissions or any standards here, and license them on the road. Now, these owners had successfully registered their Delicas in the past in Maine. And now they're being told that that is no longer an option. So I've been trying to figure out why it's not an option, and there's a lot of legalese, a lot of seems moving targets almost, what to see what exactly is going on here. But the bottom line is that these owners of these JDM vans are not able to drive their Delicas anymore. And it's sort of unclear if this will expand to other JDM vehicles, because the way that the rules are written would seemingly encompass a lot more than just this Delica minivan. So they're only targeting this van for the time being, and we'll sort of see where it goes from here. Like you said, I've been in contact with the Secretary of State office. The main DMV, which is actually the BMV, Bureau of Motor Vehicles there. And it's all semi-confusing. There isn't a whole lot of explanation for things other than just the vans are no longer legal, and that's the way it is. So I suppose look for more because I'm going to continue digging into this. I have a story up that published, I'd say about a week or so ago. That goes into much more detail with the actual legal terminology. I won't bore all of you with that on the podcast, but if you do want to look more into it, there are more details in a fairly lengthy written report of mine. So I'll just say check that out.
No, it's an interesting story. We actually were first tipped off to this by one of our freelancers. Her name is Mercedes Lilienthal. Her and her husband are really into the off-road scene. They're really just tuned into what's going on, just and also like kind of random vehicle scene too. And they were among the first to kind of hear about this, and they did some reporting on it. So shout out to them. I mean, honestly, though, when I look at this whole thing, it's interesting to me because these are kind of like cool vans. You don't see these things on the road much. And when you do, it takes you to a different time. I mean, like you said before, for me, just the obvious question is why? Like, what? Like, of all the things that you could be investing like resources on, like, I don't think these vans pose a danger, like, and it seems like there's a potential here for it to snowball a little bit. I mean, I understand that there's, you want to be aware of the public safety. You don't want people driving like bulldozers down the street or finding loopholes and like importing weird mirror, military vehicles from the Cold War that, you could get in under a loophole. Like, I get that, of course, but it's like, this just seems like a really bizarre thing to go after, especially when, I mean, my impression, the Delica poses like no threat to like people on the road any more than like another sort of vintage car. Like the dude driving the 57 Chevy, just because it was built here, that doesn't mean that's a particularly safe car, for like daily use. Or, so I don't know. It's really interesting to me, but I can't figure it out.
Maine has repeatedly cited, our federal motor vehicle safety standards and emissions as like the two overarching reasons why these Delicas are no longer allowed. And your point about the 57 Chevy, I mean, that's about as good a point as you can make. You look at this minivan from the 90s and late 80s, or you look at a Chevy from the 50s, the Chevy has significantly worse emissions, significantly worse safety, and yet those vehicles are allowed on the streets, and these vans are not. So it's so confusing, so confusing. And like you said, the Delicas pose no threat. There's probably like 15 out there, and they use them to drive up to their cabin during the summer and just go have a good time with their families, and now they're not allowed to. So we will see where
Yeah, I
it
mean,
goes.
like, I'm no expert. I've never driven one. I'm sure there's definitely some challenges. It's not like you're driving like a 2021 Camry, but I mean, there's a lot of old things on the road that are technically legal. I don't. And the other thing, what I don't get about this is it seems like it's retroactive. Like, once you've already made the call, like what? Like you're gonna go back and say, well, let's look at this car. I mean, I don't know. Just seems like it's a very interesting story to me, as you can see, but I don't get it. So how about we spend some money?
Let's do it. I like spending money.
All righty. All right. So the let's see, the writer here is trying to help their aunt buy her next car. Currently has a 2018 Honda CR-V. Before that, she had a 2011 Toyota RAV4. So that's kind of the segment that she likes and is also looking for all-wheel drive. Just safe crossover with all-wheel drive. Lease is coming up in October on the CR-V. Doesn't really want to keep it. She does have a buyout option, though. The problem is the CR-V does not have many features options. It's not really the car you want to be married to for a long time. It doesn't even have a backup camera. Looked up the value. It's only got 8,000 miles on it. So right now, that means that is a very valuable vehicle in the crazy used car market. MSRP was 21. Apparently, the current market value, according to our writer's research, is still 18.5, which is incredible. Basically, to his point, she's giving the dealer a gift if you give this car back. So there's that. They might hang on to it a little bit, all that being said. But still, looking down the road a little bit. Only real requirement is it's got to be all-wheel drive, reliable, something a little bit higher off the ground, so not a hatchback or a sedan. She lives in upstate New York, which is probably a lot like Michigan with a lot of snow. Doesn't need bells or whistles. The budget is $22,000 to $24,000. Ideally, it would be new, but a 1 or 2 year old car, which would probably still be CPO, could be a good option. Here are the choices: Kia Seltos, Nissan Kicks, Honda CR-V, Buick Encore, Volkswagen Taos, the Mazda CX-3, Toyota Corolla Cross, anything else that we might think of. They would love to hear our top two options. So that's a lot to unload. What do you think, Zach?
So, yeah, I guess I'm going to go off the book for my number one choice already. It is semi-related to one of the choices, but I would recommend a Mazda CX-30. Not the CX-3, but the CX-30. So that hits the budget. You can get one for about $24,000. I think, you know, it's also fairly comfortable, and it is tall. It's sort of like a tall Mazda 3, and the Mazda 3 is one of the best compact cars, period. I also think that the CX-30 is the best driving vehicle in the class by a long shot. And since your aunt lives in upstate New York, I'll just give a shout out to upstate New York because I went to school in Syracuse. I know that there are a lot of fun driving roads out there. So having a vehicle that is, you know, at least semi-competent on the curves and is semi, you know, fun to drive would be rather nice. And you'll have a lot more fun in a CX-30 than, say, a Toyota Corolla Cross or a Nissan Kicks. Lastly here, you know, you're getting an interior that I think is far and above, you know, the actual, like, class and luxury level of pretty much every other car on that list for the money. Mazda does really, really well with their new interior designs, and the CX-30, I think, is a fantastic option that your aunt would like and would be a really big upgrade versus the super base CR-V, because Mazda makes a lot of nice things standard on their cars. So CX-30, number one option. I'm curious to hear what your option is here, Greg.
Yeah, so I would echo that. I think that's a very good vehicle. You get a lot of design language, if you will. It's, you know, I'd say the enthusiast's choice, but it's classy. Mazda brings a certain cachet to the segment, and I think that's cool. But I would also probably throw two more here at them. I would say the RAV4, I think, it's slightly out of the price range. It looks like it starts at 26-ish, but I'm sure you could maybe get some sort of a deal on that. I think that's an interesting looking vehicle. Reminds me a little bit of a Jeep Cherokee, actually. But I think that's got some character. You can certainly get all-wheel drive. And then I would also look at the Honda CR-V. I mean, it's going to be kind of weird to go from an 18 to maybe like a 21, 22. But I really like the CR-V in this segment. I think it rides well. The interior is pretty good. And it's a Honda. You know it. You like it. It's going to be reliable. So I feel like it's a little bit of a conservative play, but I still think you're not going to be unhappy with it, especially if you step up and try to get a few options on it, maybe step up in the trim. So I think those three, you're going to like them, and you're not going to go wrong either way. So, So yeah.
Yeah, and if I were to like throw a second option out there, if the CX-30 maybe gets a little too expensive, or if you think it's too small, the Kia Seltos I think would be
Yeah.
another really good option, because I think that drives really well. And if for whatever reason you need more cargo space, because I know the CX-30 is on the smaller side of all these that we mentioned here, the Seltos is on the bigger side of all of them. So, and it's also not a drab to drive. So that'd be a neat alternative to the Mazda, I think.
And of course, with the Seltos, you get a great value. Kias and Hyundais offer you a lot of things at for a pretty good price. So, that's certainly something that could be a compelling point. So, thanks for
Definitely.
writing. Thanks for listening. Send us your Spend My Monies or any other questions you might have at podcast@autoblog.com. If you like the podcast, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next week.